midnight keynote of the International Students for Liberty Conference, entitled Why You're Living in the Libertarian Moment and What You Can Do to Keep and Expand Your Freedom. But so Nick Gillespie, editor-in-chief of Reason TV and Reason.com, which draws 2.5 million visits per month and features the staff weblog Hit and Run, named by Playboy, Washingtonian, and others as one of the best political blogs. Gillespie served as Reason Magazine's editor-in-chief from 2000 to 2008. Under his direction, Reason won the 2005 Western Publication Association Maggie Award for Best Political Magazine. Gillespie originally joined Reason's staff in 1993 as an assistant editor and ascended to the top slot in 2000. In 2004, Gillespie edited the book Choice, The Best of Reason, an anthology of the magazine's best articles. The Washington Post featured Gillespie's tenure at Reason Magazine, asking, which monthly magazine editor argues for the spread of pornography as a victory for free expression, and that drugs from marijuana to heroin should not only be legalized, but using them occasionally is just fine, and is also quite comfortable with gay marriage? The answer is Nick Gillespie, a libertarian and doctor of literature, who is injecting Reason Magazine with a pop culture sensibility. Gillespie's work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the Los Angeles Times, the New York Post, Slate, Salon, Time.com, Marketplace, and numerous other publications. He was a regular contributor to the late lamented satire site, Suck, where he wrote under the name Mr. Mixelpitalik. So without further ado, Nick Gillespie, everybody.
Thanks a lot, and I want to especially thank Alexander for inviting me to talk tonight. What I plan to do is to talk for about 15 or 20 minutes, and then we'll have questions, and then we'll have some drinks upstairs and hopefully continue the conversation as for as long as we can, or as long as we're still standing. So the title of my talk is Why You're Living in the Libertarian Moment and What You Can Do to Keep and Expand Your Freedom. And what I hopefully a couple people mentioned when they to me earlier that the title of the talk sounded kind of dubiously optimistic in this horrible period that we're living in. I mean, you guys, and given that many of you are students, your memories don't go back that far. But, I mean, you're living through a unique, what I hope is a unique one-time power grab by the state in the United States. The amount of centralization, the amount of control, the amount of intervention into every aspect of our lives is substantial, and it's growing, and it's a real issue. Yet, what I want to argue and what I've done with my colleague, Matt Welch, who's the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine, and in our 40th anniversary issue that came out in December here, we wrote a piece called The Libertarian Moment, where we argued that against a lot of the evidence, in fact, we are freer now than we ever have been, and that we are really on the cusp of a new age of freedom, just as when Reason started in the late 60s, in many ways things looked very bad. There was an unpopular war. There was a huge amount of intervention into the economy. People's lives were being controlled by politicians and by other leaders. And what happened over the last 40 years is actually, by any measure, I think, across the board, people are more free. And more free to live their lives, which is the basic underpinning of libertarianism. And I think that there are reasons to believe that we're in a similar situation, that no matter how bad things get, they can always get worse, of course, but they tend to get better for reasons that we'll talk about a little bit today. But what I want to do first is because and one of the things that I as my introduction pointed out, I'm a lit major. My background's in literary studies. So unlike a lot of economists who know much more about math and economics than I do, and who see darkness everywhere, that a quarter of a percent of a sales tax goes up, and that's a loss of freedom, and it certainly is, much less the stimulus package, much less many of the things emanating from just down the street here. One of the basic understandings, or, you know, if are we living in an individual age? Do you feel free to be an individual? That is really the ultimate litmus test of whether or not we're more free or less free, I think. And what I want to do is show you a short slideshow with some musical accompaniment, and then I want to bring it back to why I think that why this slideshow illustrates an enormous growth of freedom, and it also points to ways that we can think about stuff you know, coming down the line. Some of you, I trust, recognize not simply the song, which is My Way, which was written by a guy named Paul Anka based on a French song originally, and then he appropriated the tune and the lyrics, but that specific performance, which is Sid Vicious, who's the guy down there on the bottom, the former bassist of the Sex Pistols in 1978. And I want to use this as a kind of morality tale to talk about how you're freer than you might think. The uses to which My Way has been put in its three best-known versions, which are Frank Sinatra's The Man on the Top, Elvis Presley in the middle, and Sid Vicious's. Underscore how rock music is a kind of technology that has allowed for a growth in individual expression, individual identity, possibilities, just kind of trying out all different types of freedom. And often in ways which are unpredictable and difficult to control. Now, Sinatra was the first great pop culture teen idol. You still, if you talk to your parents, say, or your grandparents, or you guys are young enough, maybe your great-grandparents, I don't know, but they'll swear that, you know, the kids back in the day loved Frank Sinatra in a way that nobody really loved Elvis as much, or the Beatles, or whoever, the Backstreet Boys. I'm already dating myself in terms of this stuff. But Sinatra was not only the first teen idol, really, in a modern sense. He hated rock and roll, and he specifically hated Elvis Presley, who became the person. Elvis personified rock and roll, which undid Frank Sinatra's kind of style of music as dominant. In 1957, Sinatra seethed that rock and roll, and I'm quoting him here, rock and roll smells phony and false. It's sung, played, and written for the most part by cretinous goons. By means of its almost imbecilic reiteration, it manages to be the martial music of every sideburned delinquent on the face of the earth. You know you've drawn blood when Frank Sinatra calls you a cretinous goon and doesn't mean it as a compliment. Sinatra gained a small measure of comfort when, in the late 50s, Elvis was drafted into the army and effectively neutered as a cultural rebel. John Lennon of the Beatles once said that Elvis died the day he went into the army. But after serving his hitch, Elvis made a much ballyhooed return to public performing in 1960 on Frank Sinatra's variety show on a network channel. And Sinatra could rest assured that order in the pop music universe had been restored and that at least this cretinous goon had been shown his place where Elvis was performing on his show. As a decade, the 60s were not particularly kind to either Frank Sinatra or Elvis Presley. Elvis made a series of awful movies, some of which you may have seen, eroding both his image and his fan base. He just became out of touch with anything going on in America, it seemed. And Sinatra also appeared in embarrassing movies, which I highly recommend, such as Tony Rome and Lady in Cement, where he played a self-parodic tough guy detective who wore flood pants and lived on a houseboat. They're quite wonderful. As a writer named James Miller pointed out in a history of rock and roll called Flowers in the Dustbin, Sinatra recorded My Way in 1969 as what he called a bit of fluff for the kids. It represented one of his last bids. He was an old man by this point. He was about 60. It represented one of his last bids to make a dent in the youth market. For the same album, he recorded his glorious absurd version of the Simon and Garfunkel song Mrs. Robinson, which I also recommend. Now, My Way for Sinatra, it failed to impress the kids at all. It didn't go anywhere, but it was wildly popular amongst Sinatra's more mature audience. And within 2 years of recording the song, it had become Sinatra's great signature song, My Way. And, you know, Sinatra lived his life his way, et cetera. And he used it routinely to close his shows. Now, around the same time, however, Elvis started singing the song in his live shows, and he started to appropriate the song from Sinatra, featuring it prominently on his most popular later album, which is called Aloha from Hawaii Live via Satellite. Slowly, My Way became Elvis's song, too, as well as Frank's. And when Elvis died in August 1977, the King made a posthumous bid for sole ownership of the tune. In October 1977, CBS aired a documentary about Elvis, which featured him singing a spectacular, if grotesque, version of My Way. As Miller, in his book Flowers in the Dustbin, puts it, there was Elvis on stage, monstrously overweight, stuffed like a sausage into one of his custom-tailored powder blue jumpsuits, delivering an especially painful and pathos-filled version of My Way. The song's opening lines, suggest Miller's, were delivered with grim aplomb. Now the end is near, and I must face the final curtain. Elvis was singing his own epitaph, and when his record company released the live version posthumously as a single, it became the King's final massive international hit. Elvis had once again stolen Sinatra's thunder, and it all started with a song meant to appeal to kids. Now, there's one more turn in this scenario, which brings us to Sid Vicious. Elvis's version and Death of My Way, Death and the posthumous release of My Way, inspired Malcolm McLaren, who is the impresario behind the Sex Pistols, to film, record, and release a punk version of My Way, which you've just heard, as a mocking tribute to Elvis and presumably to Sinatra as well. In the film footage of the song, Sid Vicious, previously known for wearing swastika and shredded clothes, appears in formal attires and warbles his way through the opening of My Way before tearing into the song in gutter fashion. At the end of the song, he starts shooting a cap gun into the audience, updating the existential romance of what's known as the gratuitous act of violence, and in a sly way commenting on the violent subtext of Sinatra's persona. So, with that as a backdrop, let me ask, what's the moral of this tale of cultural appropriation, where you have a song that is intended for one audience, grafts into another, and then ends up somewhere else completely? Given that Elvis, Sid Vicious, and Frank Sinatra are all dead, one possibility is that singing My Way inevitably leads to death. Given that all three were, to various degrees, both drug-dependent and very successful, maybe the lesson is that real winners do use drugs. We might add Michael Phelps to that category. But the real moral of the story is this, and that's what the procession of rock images, of rock stars and rock bands and rock personalities, starting from the 50s on up through the 21st century. I mean, you see a glorious procession of just weird people who are riffing off of each other, of the past, inventing something completely new, but constantly expressing themselves in bizarre ways and wonderful ways, is that pop music perfectly encapsulates the freedom that you yourself have to create your identity, your meaning, your community, your sense of who you are and how you are going to engage the world. The procession of often absurd people in what's sometimes called the rock and roll circus, and certainly that's what my slideshow highlighted, is that individuals are constantly adding new dimensions to existing categories, or busting through those categories, or ignoring them altogether, and striking out for completely new territory. And what is true about rock, and I want you to think about rock music or pop music as a kind of technology of living, a technology of expression that can be applied in different ways, is certainly true of the world that we all live in. It's impossible to predict and ultimately impossible to control. And what I want to talk about here is that I will make the argument, and we can argue about this, but that you guys, without necessarily knowing it, you've been born in the golden age of the individual. Due to vast increases in wealth, education, and especially, I believe, technology, you are more able to express yourself and to tap into new communities, create other communities, avoid communities that are repressing you or that are squelching you or stultifying you. Part of this is, and these things are all kind of interconnected, we have more wealth because we have more freedom. Freedom allows smart individuals, creative individuals, lazy individuals to benefit from all sorts of things. Technology, and think of that term broadly, it can be the internet, which is an amazingly decentralizing technology. The personal computer before that, the internet is essentially a bunch of computers that are networked together. That is massive. Before that, the personal computer, which more from other more centralized computers, large mainframe computers, things like that, all increasing our ability to express ourselves, to produce and consume whatever culture we want, to communicate in a way. How many of you have communicated using a cell phone? Right? How many of you have communicated in ways that your parents know nothing about? I hope to God all of you, you know. But, I mean, and you could always do that, you know. I mean, kids are always disappointing and routing around their parents. But it's much easier now, and there are more ways to do it. And it's very liberating, very freeing. There has been, and that builds into the age of the individual, this libertarian moment that we're in. There is a decentralization partly due to, I mean, if you have more money and you have more education, for instance, the number of kids, the percentage of high school graduates who go directly onto college now is much higher. It's about 20% more than it was in 1980. About two-thirds of kids immediately go on to college. The more educated you get, not only the smarter that you get, hopefully, but you also feel more empowered to demand things or to control things in your life. You know, when you graduate from college, you're more likely to say, I want to live this way. I'm not going to just put up with somebody else telling me what to do. Wealthier people, and we are all wealthier than we were 30 years ago or 50 years ago, are more demanding. I want it done my way, or I want to try this. Or you feel like you have money, you have resources, so you're willing to take more risks. All of this leads to a decentralization of traditional sources of power in both the public sector and the private sector. To talk about the private sector, when you think if any of you had been this age 50 years ago, the odds are that there would have been any number of private organizations such as churches or community groups or whatever that would have enforced much more rigid codes on you, codes of behavior, codes of expectations. The private sector was the place, or the non-governmental sector, enforced gender roles. So if you were a woman, you had many fewer options. You had many fewer choices because it was considered not a good thing for women to do to act this way or that way. For men, there were fewer models to choose from. There's a great anthropologist named Grant McCracken who has written a book called Plenitude, where he looks at the way in which the roles or the possible identities for high school kids has just exploded from in 1960. You could essentially be, if you were a boy, one of three things. You could be a nerd, a jock, or a hood, like a criminal. And when you look at kids now coming out of high school, there are almost infinite number of possibilities. It's like going into a Starbucks, where you can effectively have an infinite number of coffee drinks that you tailor to yourself. It's also true of personalities or identities. But the private sector forces of repression have faded in a way that you get to choose more what communities and what subcommunities you're part of. In the public sector, in a lot of ways, the government is taking more of our money, or in certain ways it is. It regulates more things. There are more federal regulations on the books now than there was 2 years ago, 20 years ago, 50 years ago. By the same token, the percentage of the government's take of gross domestic product has stayed within a band that's roughly about the same, somewhere between about 18 and 24%. That's probably going to go up a bit in the United States. But even in the public sector, the government no longer controls things the way that it used to. In the 1970s, you couldn't shop. In most parts of the country, you couldn't shop for things like furniture or books or whatever on Sunday. There were blue laws. Did any of you ever encounter blue laws? You know, they're fading, or they faded. I mean, there's still some remnants of them, but much different than it was. The government just can't do that. And even when the government takes more of your money or regulates more of your behavior, you tend to have more options beyond that. More options for travel, more options for expressing yourself or going elsewhere, more money left over, so that you can buy your way out of something or into something else. So there's a huge decentralization which feeds into the age of the individual. And one of the great things, and you guys are living in it, there has been, generally speaking, over the past 30 years, the past 50 years, and it continues apace, a recognition of the central role of choice in all human endeavors. Whether you're talking about identity, I choose to be this person or that person. Culture. I choose this culture. I'm going to create a culture as opposed to just take what is given to me. And in terms of globalization, I understand that there's people from about 11 or 12 different countries here. Think about how much more interconnected, or go back and ask your parents, did they roam around the globe as freely as we do? And this is even after 9/11, where there's been a crackdown on the ability to kind of move around. But there's no question that compared to 30 years ago, we trade more with other countries. We travel more in other countries. We travel more around the United States. There's much more choosing and much more directed activity. And all of this adds to a great libertarian age of the individual, where you not only have more options, but you know you have more options, and everybody recognizes on some basic level that choice is a good thing. Whether you're talking about the choice of your religion, the choice of your school, the choice of your coffee beverage, the choice of where you live, people understand that choice is a good thing and that it empowers the individual, decentralizes power, and helps increase wealth, education, technology. So, that's why we're free. And now I'll end with just a quick kind of peroration on how we might go about keeping and expanding our freedom. And again, this is against the backdrop of the single biggest You know, I'm 45, so I've got more than a few years on you guys. The single biggest power grab in our life, if you look at the Patriot Act passed in 2001, a huge power grab, not quite unprecedented in American history, but gigantic in a lot of different ways. What we are seeing now is the economic equivalent, the regulatory equivalent, the fiscal and monetary policy equivalent of the Patriot Act, a gigantic, transformative piece of legislation rushed through without any real thought for the future or how it will be implemented. It's very scary. It's very disturbing and, upsetting on any number of levels. And yet we're still free. And we will continue to be free. And here's some of the ways that we can keep the freedom that we have that's better than we had a generation or two ago and possibly expand it. And for me, and you guys are at the epicenter. You will be the people who push forward into a new era of freedom or fall back under a blanket of repression. But I have three basic points here. The first is don't fall for the idea that politics is central to human flourishing, that politics is the arena of activity where what matters happens. It isn't. Getting away from politics is, and that's the basic libertarian message. Politics is they're a lagging indicator of what's going on in America, which is one of the reasons why every other area, if you look at different industries and different services and things like that, when you go to a coffee shop, when you go to a movie theater, when you go anywhere, you will get tons of choice. When you look at politically areas or industries that are heavy in politics, that have a lot of political activity going on, such as education and healthcare, you notice immediately that there is less choice. There are less options. There is less interest in the individual. Politics are a lagging indicator of where the action is in America, and don't think that politics are central to human flourishing. Politics are a zero-sum game where somebody wins and somebody loses, or 51% vote to take the money of the other 49%, and they rub your face in it. The libertarian message is essentially we should shrink politics, which is a harsh arena where there are clear winners and losers, to the smallest realm possible so that we have more time and more energy and more resources to devote to other areas, whether it's culture, whether it's industry, whether it's business, services, whatever, where it's not the same. You don't lose when you are in a business environment where all sorts of innovative products are coming out. People don't lose in the same way that they do in the political thing. So that's the first thing about keeping and expanding your freedom, is that make it clear that politics should be subjugated to real human life and where the action is. The second is leverage the engagement of your peers and hold liberals and conservatives to their expressed ideology. This past election and over the past several years, there has been a real bump up in the amount of youth interest in politics, in partisan politics, in affiliating with either the Democratic or the Republican Party, which reverses decades of decline in this type of stuff. Now, ask your colleagues, your classmates, your friends, your family, people who are around you, did they vote for Barack Obama and did they vote for hope and change so that we can pull out of Iraq and put more troops into Afghanistan? Did they vote for hope and change because the Democrats are in favor of gay marriage or in favor of recognizing alternative lifestyles as equal? And if so, then why hasn't why is Barack Obama and why is Joe Biden? Why are they against gay marriage then? Why are they expanding the state into areas that it doesn't belong? Why are they pushing for more economic regulation, which in the end means limiting individuals' choices? Ask them where the hope and change comes from and make them face up to the fact that their ideology and their expressed ideology is often totally contrary to the politics that they espouse. The same thing with conservatives who believe in limited government. If conservatives say that they're about minimizing government, then they need to explain the Bush years, where on virtually every level, government grew by leaps and bounds. And this is, George Bush and the Republicans pushed for more spending, for more regulation, for more, getting into every nook and cranny of American society. And that's, leverage people's interests. And when they say I'm liberal, I'm for free expression. I'm liberal. I'm for individual freedom. You know, call them on that. Call conservatives who say that they're for that, but they want, you know, except for here, there, and the other place where the state should dictate choices or eliminate certain choices. You know, one way of thinking about this is that oftentimes, you know, the old joke was that liberals wanted the government out of the bedroom and conservatives wanted a government out of the boardroom. And they both, are, you know, but they both want to get into the other realm. You know, hold people to that or explain to them why, if you believe in individualism, if you believe in choice, if you believe in growth, you know, get government out of the bedroom and the boardroom. And then finally, I want to suggest that you, you know, the other thing that you can do, and this is far more important than being politically engaged or, you know, busting on all of your friends who are who call themselves Democrats or Republicans or liberals or conservatives, create the next rock and roll or inner tubes, and by which I mean a decentralizing, empowering, do-it-yourself technology. You can do this, and you don't have to write code, and you don't have to be able to carry a tune, but you can live your life as a work of art and an act of discovery, create your own identity, create your own community, and create your own meaning, and you will have people who don't follow you but understand that and use that as inspiration, and that's the most important thing: is to live life as much on your own terms at all times, within a political within political debates, but also in personal ways as well. And I am I'm going to stop there, and let's have some questions, and we'll continue the conversation. Thank you.
And I'd ask you what your thoughts are on. I know Reason's done a lot of good work on the immigration stuff.
Yeah, immigration is a is a real flashpoint issue. I mean, and a lot of people. I mean, I think the only proper libertarian perspective is that individuals should be free to move wherever they want and live and work wherever they want. The only kind of immigration crisis that we have is when people stop moving to places. And Reason has done a ton of work on this. There is no immigration crisis in America, certainly. But one of the things to ask is you go back to this is a good time to go back to what's called first principles. Are individuals free or should they be free? And if you say yes, then you should be interested in having more people move freely around the world, just as we move around the states and whatnot. So and I everybody wins with that. How about here?
On that same issue, if you go back 100 years, there was free immigration. Trade made up a larger percentage of this country and my country's GDP. Globalization worked. Since then, we've had breakdown, re-emergence of globalization, and so on. I think in terms of libertarianism, this is far less a golden age than it was 100 years ago. In terms of libertinism, I think you're right. I'd like to see both at the same time, sure, who wouldn't? But that's surely for the private sector to work out rather than...
And I think that we would agree that private sector libertinism is advisable, public sector libertinism not so much. But I mean, the fact is that since World War II, I mean, there has been more, the volumes of global trade have been increasing. And the real
question, you know, when you think the metaphor, controlling metaphor for... for our age is the network as opposed to other systems of organization. And the real challenge for us in terms of globalization, in terms of trade, in terms of commerce, is bringing more people into the network. The parts of the world that are poor, that are backwards, that offer fewer options for their inhabitants are those that are not part of the network. So it's always about trying to build out those networks. And I think we're all familiar with the Adam Smith line that where goods cross borders, armies don't. So it's also a way of not only making people better off, but it also helps keep the peace. Yeah.
Do you think the Ron Paul movement was a positive step for libertarianism in general?
Reason, and I myself have written a fair amount about Ron Paul. I disagree with Ron Paul on a lot of very specific issues, such as immigration. I can understand what he's saying. I don't understand why he thinks that way. I think overall what was great about the Ron Paul movement in this past election cycle were a couple of things. And one is that he was the anti-war candidate. Barack Obama was not the anti-war candidate. He brought it to the forefront, and he made it clear. I mean, this was a war that was wildly unpopular, the Iraq War. He was the only candidate who was just unambiguously against it and against a kind of interventionist foreign policy. And he did quite well with it. And I think Obama became more of an anti-war candidate because he saw that it was not poison for Ron Paul. But the more important thing is that Paul had a message, like despite his certain policy issues that I don't fully understand. I mean, he's against NAFTA and free trade agreements because he says it's not really free trade, it's managed trade, et cetera. I think, you know, NAFTA has been a very big success in that the closer you get towards free trade, you know, the better, even if it's not perfect. But his basic message was that I don't want to run the world because I don't know how. I don't want to run your life because we all have different values. And I don't want to run the economy, as he used to say, because in a free society, individuals run the economy through all of their different choices. That's what people responded to. And I think it was very positive. I mean, it brought a lot of new people into politics. And it also, it's a very positive, very libertarian message. How about somebody in the back?
Jason Kuznicki, Cato Institute. I think that a lot of what you were actually talking about could be put into the classic division between negative freedoms and positive freedoms. And it's great that we have the positive freedoms to rock and roll and to dress in funny clothes and all that. That's wonderful. But I don't know if that's libertarianism. I think libertarianism is supposed to be, and classically, much more concerned with negative freedoms, the freedom to be left alone.
Sure.
And I understand and accept and value what you talked about, but I worry that there are also ever greater encroachments on our negative freedoms. This is a country where we have 1% of the adult population in prison now.
Right.
Now, I don't know that trade-off is worthwhile, for example.
Yes.
To touch on the drug war, this is a place where, I mean, libertarians are the only ones with a consistent and a principled message on drug prohibition or on prohibition in general, which is that if you are a responsible adult, you should be allowed to, you know, you should be allowed to sleep with who you want, to eat what you want, to smoke what you want, to do what you want with your body. It's your body, as long as you're not putting other people at risk by getting high and driving or whatever. Here's a question. I mean, are we closer or further away from the end of the drug war as we know it? And I would argue that we are, in fact, getting closer to the end. One of my dreams is that we will have a Berlin Wall moment. The Berlin Wall fell in a way that nobody predicted. I mean, the CIA earlier that year had been predicting, you know, basically had been saying, you know, international communism was going to be with us forever and ever, et cetera. And then, it just disappeared. Retroactively, you could see why it was about to fall apart. I think something like that with the drug war will happen, partly to go back to what I was talking about. We live in an increasing age of individual choice, and people recognize that as a good thing. And people demand choice because, they're no longer – more and more people are demanding to live the life they want to live. And implicit in that is the right to be left alone. And I think that I'm not sure – I don't disagree with anything you say. I mean, I think that compared to when I grew up, it's easier to express yourself, and that's a good thing, and that leads to more freedom in more areas. So, anyone else? Yeah.
This is kind of a related follow-up on that. I don't know if this is true. I just heard this statistically that more and more young people are in favor of legalizing marijuana, for example, but more and more young people, in fact, the majority, are also in favor of basically outlawing smoking of cigarettes.
Right.
What do you make of that, the increase in acceptance of sort of nanny state while also increasing in acceptance of, you know, recreational drug use?
One of the things is that,
freedom isn't linear. It's not like we go across the board from an era of slavery and move towards, you know, total slavery into total freedom, and you get all of these weird things going on where, so for instance, and there are actually recent surveys that show there is more support among the general population for legalizing marijuana than ever in the past 40 or 50 years. Which is a good thing. And for medical marijuana, it's even higher and things like that. And at the same time, you know, where you also have people taking more and more drugs, not simply to cure ills or to get rid of diseases, but to make themselves feel better, whether it's Prozac or to concentrate better or Adderall, erectile dysfunction drugs. I mean, things that are pure pleasure. Marijuana legalization is more positive now. And at the same time, you have all of this other stuff. I think the way that you have to look at it also is that we, overall, are you moving towards more choices or fewer choices? And that's, you know, that's where the impetus lies. I mean, I think that there's also, we are getting to a point where people are sick and tired of the most kind of excruciatingly tiny prohibitions on smoking. I mean, in various places in California, some towns have banned smoking in every situation except for single-family dwellings, and that's creating something of a backlash. So, you know, I'm positive that, or I'm optimistic that people are moving towards more choices, even when they recognize that some of those choices might not be particularly healthy. Okay, one more. Okay, how about right here?
And do you see? I guess culturally, we're getting away from that, but there still is institutions.
Yeah, well, and you know, one of the things that I want to stress too, and this is this is where I think I am talking about
libertarianism, not libertinism. You don't break out of something in order to escape morality, but rather to escape a particular morality that does not serve you. I'm not a religious person. I was raised Catholic, which pretty much cured me of wanting to be Catholic, and I thank my parents for making that choice for me. But the religion is a great and good thing, and there are many types of religious, and religious communities have added an enormous amount of value to an enormous number of people's lives. But what's really important, and this is something that is very much at the root of what became libertarian political philosophy, particularly in 17th century England, where there was a religious war, and it wasn't to escape religion, it was to be able to choose your religion and to worship God as you understood him or her, or to not at all. I mean, to be an atheist. And that's what's key, is that it's great that there are repressive, or what I might consider repressive social structures around for people who want to be in that world or want to be in that community, just as it's great that there are other ones that suit me in different ways. And the point is, you know, can you choose? Can you choose among competing jurisdictions? Can you choose among competing visions of the good life? And you should, you can, and you must, and also that you realize that it's a discovery process, just as markets. You probably all heard that the markets and the price system are, it's a discovery process, because the fact is nobody knows what something is worth at any given point in time. I mean, it's all a jumble, and we all value things subjectively. So our, you know, what we think is really important or really valuable one day, the next day it isn't. I mean, we've all been to garage sales, you know, and nothing that got sold at a garage sale was bought at the price that it's being sold at, right? I mean, all the exercise equipment in the world is super valuable one day, and then you're buying, you know, an exercise bike for $5 or something, right? It's the same way with life. I mean, it's a discovery process, and it will change over time. And the important thing is that you get to choose. I mean, this is the definition of liberal politics, that you get to choose among competing visions of the good life, which will change for yourself over time. And that's one of the reasons why, when you look around in the business sector, when you look around in the kind of identity market, when you look at rock, when you look at movies, when you look at this and you just see this incredible flowering of all different choices, all different ideas, it's very bracing. And that's what we need to bring to politics, where you have more choices rather than few choices. Instead of two parties, maybe you have 10. Instead of saying everything is – I mean, politics is about control. Life is about choice. And to the extent that we bring that to the political sphere and cram the political sphere into the smallest pocket on our hip, the better off we'll be. So I think we're going to go upstairs, and we'll make some choices between beer, wine, and soft drinks. So thank you very much. And thank you, Alex.